It has only a list argument if you have already applied it to the natural number argument. Yes, so that's okay. So this is Haskell notation, right? Where you have so space applies a function to an argument. Right. So this is the okay. So I've heard that. So this jumping back and forth between applicative notation with brackets and just application by juxtaposition, as in Haskell, is confusing to some. It will be sort of hard to give up, because otherwise I run into trouble with covering the blackboard in brackets, right? So I mean, there is a reason that Haskell writes application by juxtaposition. But if there is anything unclear about this, ask me. Well, as now, actually, of course. Yeah. So explicitly, yes. So it's a function that is described in number 2c in partially applied form, right? So we have already applied it to a natural number argument n, and what we get is a function that only expects a list argument. And yes, so the recursion requires changing the parameter n as well. But the recursion should be over the list, not over the natural number. That's why it's written this way here, right? So I mean, in principle, you could do recursion over either of them, right? So you could have the idea of doing the recursion over the natural numbers argument, and this works fine for some time until you notice precisely the case that came up in the question just now. If you do recursion over the natural number, then you need to do a case distinction at some point over whether the list is empty. If you do recursion over the list argument, then basically that goes away, because you're doing case distinction over that anyway. So, but yes, so this is one of those cases, basically, where, so in that case, maybe writing it that way is, again, somewhat unfortunate. The fold, if you get this as a fold, then the type is really this. So basically that reflects what I was just saying, right? So the recursion is over this part, so that's what you get when you write a fold. And the natural number argument is hidden here by currying. So it is one of those currying exercises again, just now with arguments of different types. All right, what's going to happen here, of course, is you change. I can show this shortly. So in the recursive call here, you apply this function here, right? And you apply it to the predecessor of the current argument. So this sounds a bit like there would be a case distinction coming up on whether there is a predecessor or not, right? So it could be the current argument could be zero. I mean, feel free to describe the function that you apply the fold to in whichever way they like in this case, right? So don't worry about it excessively, about writing it in point-free style. So, here's a hint to this. For this case at least, it's no case, no problem at all. I will not deem it a problem to write fold r of something and point full, because here there will be a slight issue about the zero. Yes.
Yeah, but I'm still a bit confused, because in the exercise, take n the natural number as the first argument.
Yeah, the natural number is the first argument. So what I really define is something like uncurry of swap of take or something, right? So,
okay, yeah.
So as the in the end, I have to fiddle with the arguments. I mean, write it this way, then the order of the arguments is changed. Yeah. So the I mean, basically, that's what you do. You encode primitive recursion in fold by basically currying, and that's of course primitive recursion over the first argument only. And if you want primitive recursion over another argument, say the second, then you have to swap the arguments around before you curry, basically. So let me briefly think whether I was wondering whether the case for zero is a proper case distinction or whether we can just ignore it. Well, okay, so strictly speaking, the if you want to write the function that you put here in a point-free manner, then this will again be a fold, this time over the natural numbers, right? Which gives you your case distinction, basically. But like I said, so let's not overdo it in this case. Just don't worry about writing this function in whichever manner you like, basically. Right. Also, there was an issue brought up by Merlin, which was that in which of the exercises, again, you need to use evaluation if you want to write point freestyle. Open here. Yeah, but in the second has several items. Which one was that? That's the. The multiplication one, right? So, hint for 2a is there's this evaluation function that we've seen, right? And this can usefully be applied in this exercise. Right, any further questions? Okay, so basically, so let's just fix this for 2a or 2 altogether, right? So the main point is to write the thing as a fold, whether or not the arguments of fold or the parameters of fold are actually written in point free style, I'll leave to your taste, basically, right? More questions? Right, for now. So if there's any questions that come up between now and Friday, do send email or something, or just show up. Okay. Right. Okay, so now for the actual topic of the course. Well, or according to McLean, one of the two preparatory steps leading up to the actual topic of things, which is natural transformations, but we won't actually see it that way very much. So we're going to be talking about categories and functors largely. So categories. Before I give a formal definition, let's run through some examples. In the data type section, we've been working with one particular category, which is the category of sets. So what are important things there? Well, sets are evidently important, and maps are important. We've seen various bits of structure here, and let me highlight two bits here. So we've had the composition operation, which takes two functions that adjoin at the ends and composes them. And we've seen identity maps. We've also seen other things. So we've seen products, we've seen evaluation maps. What we haven't seen is sums, which also exists somewhere. So there's all sorts of other structure that might or might not turn out to be generalizable in some way. And let's look at one more important thing, posets. Okay, posets, that's short for partially ordered sets, or just ordered sets, or partial orders, or orders, very shortly. What are these? Well, they're pairs consisting of a set X and a relation, typically written less than or equal, which of course is binary. So it's a subset of X times X. And it's governed by three axioms. It's reflexive and transitive. Everybody knows what that is. And it's also anti-symmetric. Everybody clear with that? Nodding. Yes. Okay, so that's a partially ordered set. Well, and then of course the question is, well, what corresponds to the maps? Of course I can talk about maps between these things. I mean, I've got sets on either side and I can just consider maps, but that's not usually what I'm going to be interested in. And in fact, there is a notion of a monotone map, which is something that runs between two ordered sets. For clarity, I'm going to write the inequality in the second one as less than or equal prime for now. I will later not have a problem with just writing less than or equal everywhere for these things. And what does it mean for such a map to be monotone? Well, monotone means it preserves the ordering. That is, whenever x is less than or equal to y, then f of x is going to be less than or equal to f of y. So that's actually the usual notion of monotonicity that should be known from engineering math 1, right? So when we talk about a map on the real numbers being monotone, what we mean is precisely this. Sorry? Without the prime, of course, because that's a monotone endo map from the prime missing, right, of course, yeah. So the prime's missing here, of course, yeah. So I'm going to give this up immediately, I just didn't. So. okay, so there's apparently this notion of map that is, well, say, adapted to what happens in partially ordered sets. And, well, what about composition? Of course, we can compose these maps, right? So they're maps, nothing keeps us from composing them. The question is, if we take two monotone maps, is what comes out again going to be monotone? Clearly, right? If there's another map. There's some other map G, monotone from Y to Y and less than or equal prime to Z and less than or equal double prime. Then, of course, if I start with X being less than or equal to Y, then monotonicity of F is still going to give me this. And then if G is also monotone, then this is going to imply that G of Fx is less than or equal double prime to G of f of y, and the implication from n to n tells me that G composed with f is still monotone. Okay, so apparently I can compose monotone maps in the sense that I can take two monotone maps, compose them, and get a monotone map. And of course, the identity, you know, this is a record in chaos, probably, right? So, so the identity map, of course, is also monotone. I mean, clearly it satisfies this implication here, right? Okay, so what happens here? Basically, we're looking at, so these things are going to become categories once I eventually formally define what that is. So if, apparently I'm looking at categories as being some sort of generic notion of mathematical structure. So so the name is not actually that unreasonable, right? So a category is a species of mathematical structure, if you will. So just being a set is a mathematical structure and being partially ordered is a mathematical structure. Okay, let's introduce, how many more? Two more, I guess. Well, this is always this Spanish Inquisition problem. Let me introduce just two more things that are just basic mathematical knowledge that some have and some don't. Vector spaces. So just for statistics, who knows what a vector space is formally? One. Keep your hands up, I want to count, please. So the mathematicians do, obviously. Okay, and basically the computer scientists sort of do, and many don't, half and half, right? So yeah, I've heard that the definition actually doesn't come up in engineering math, is that true? Right. Hans Peter said that already. Okay. I'm not going to comment on that. So, what's a vector space? Well, first of all, I have to say what the K is that appears there, right? So, I'm not going to say what K is. Don't have the time for that. So what K is as a structure, I'm just going to give examples of what K could be, namely the two examples that typically crop up. So think of K as being either the reals or the complex numbers. So what's important about these things? Well, I can do what's called the bourgeois arithmetic in German on these things. Bürgerliches Rechnen, which means I can add these things, I can multiply them, I can subtract them, and I can divide them. So there are some things that I cannot always do. For instance, I cannot always compare them, right? So I cannot sensibly compare two natural numbers for size, at least not in a way that wouldn't have some very unexpected property, in particular wouldn't be a partial order. So I can calculate with these things. And then what's a typical letter for a vector space? V. So V is a set with, let me count. What can I get away with? Well, just two operations really. So V is a set with two operations, plus and times, where plus is a binary operation on the space, and times is a multiplication of vector elements by elements of K. So K is called the field of scalars. So what I do is I multiply a vector by a scalar. And what comes out is a vector. So that's the two operations that I have in a vector space. Okay, and then there's axioms governing this, of course. Some of the axioms concern just the plus. So plus is associative, okay, unsurprising. It's also commutative. And it has a neutral element, which we write zero. We don't need to include it in the signature because the neutral element is actually uniquely determined. And not only that, is also, and it is going to be automatically preserved by the maps that we introduce. Okay, and scalar multiplication then has some axioms. Let me see if I can remember them all. So I could basically multiply a vector by a scalar and then multiply it by a scalar again. And this is equal to first multiplying the scalars and then multiplying the vector with them. Then I could add two scalars and multiply a vector by them, and that's the same as doing the multiplication separately and then adding the two vectors. So it's a sort of distributive law, except of course this is sort of over-suggestive in the notation, because this plus here isn't the same as that plus, right? So this here is plus on scalars, this here is plus on vectors. Okay, then there's the neutral element in the scalars, which I can now just write one without explaining it, because I'm going to, because I've said the scalars are either the reals or the complex numbers, so one is clear. I can multiply a vector by one, and what comes out should be just the vector. Okay, and all right, I forgot something about plus. Plus has inverses, and the inverse of x I'm going to write minus x. So in particular, I can prove that a zero times a vector is zero from the axioms that I've seen, because, well, that's because I can write zero as a difference. So I'm going to write this over formally as one plus minus one. So this here is the d minus one that we know and love, right? So so this here clearly exists. And I can write this instead of zero. And I can apply my distributive law. So my distributive law says that, okay, now I'm going to run into a situation where it probably transpires I've forgotten an axiom or something. So this is 1 times v plus minus 1 times v. So now this is going to be 0 once I prove that. So let's write this here as star, which, because it's something I yet have to prove. So minus 1 times v should be the same as minus 1 times v. So let's worry about that in a moment. That's going to be zero. Crap, this is over 20 years ago, so probably remembering the axiomatics wrong, right? So hello, mathematicians, is zero times v actually, zero times v equals zero actually an axiom? No, it's not an axiom, right? So, I can show it using 0 plus 0, of course. Never mind that. So forget this proof. Yeah, right. Much nicer. So 0 times v equals 0 times 0 plus 0 times v equals 0 times v plus 0 times v. Okay, now this should imply that by subtracting, well, I can subtract 0 times v on both sides, right? So here, right? So there is a vector minus 0 times v because there are inverses. I can add this on both sides. On the left side, it will cancel out the 0 times v. On the right side, it will cancel out just one of the 0 times v's. So I get 0 equals 0 times v. And actually, this calculation is then useful after all because this shows that minus 1 times v is actually the additive inverse of 1 times v, or more generally, that well, not more generally, 1 times v is actually v, so this shows that minus 1 times v is the inverse of v, right? So this comes out of this calculation here. Okay, so that's vector spaces. And again, I can wonder about maps. And well, presumably these should be compatible with the structure that I have somehow. So say I have a map from a vector space V to a vector space W. Well, I'm going to say that such a thing is linear if it's compatible with the two operations that I have. So first of all, F of V plus W should be F of V plus F of W. And moreover, for the other operation, F of A times V should be, well, something times F of V. Well, the A isn't actually affected by the map, right? So the map does nothing to the real number. So I demand that this is just A times F of V. So that's a linear map. So we can basically go and complete our very chaotic table here, right? So we can now talk about vector spaces. There's an associated notion of map that I have, the linear maps. And well, you all remember from, I'm pretty sure that there was mention of linear maps in Engineering Math 1, right? And maybe you all remember that the composite of two linear maps is again a linear map and actually reflected in, well, if I write it in matrix notation by matrix multiplication, right? So matrix multiplication is composition of linear maps. And of course, the identity is linear. So these structures keep copying them. So let us now let us now get some water to wipe the blackboard. Thank you. By the way, could we maybe open these little non-windows? I mean, you can't really call them windows because they're airing slits or whatever. So, okay, following these examples, let us now get down to actually defining what a category is. So, a category. Our typical letters for this are going to be, capital letters from the beginning of the alphabet in script font, right? So this here is meant to be script C. So it consists of, first of all, a lot of data. Firstly, a class that we write obc of things we're going to call objects. Remember from one of the first sessions that a class is an overlarge set, basically. In particular, the collection of all sets forms a class, but not a set, Russell's paradox. Right? Then. Given any two objects, A and B, we require a set, not a class, really a set, that we write either C of A and B, or HOM of A and B, if the category is somehow clear or we don't want to mention it or something. Sometimes the category is nameless, so we want a way to write the set anyway. Or sometimes we want to do both and then write the category in the index. Of things that we're going to call morphisms, from A to B, and the fact that F is a morphism from A to B is going to be written this style here, F colon A to B, or quite often we're going to instead write the F on top of the arrow, in particular when we write diagrams consisting of these things, then the F is always going to be on the arrow. Right. Then, for each object A, we require a morphism identity on A, which is a morphism from A to A itself. And Lastly, for any three objects A, B, C, an operation that we're going to write with the little circle as like the composition of maps that we've seen. And it goes from C of B and C, so morphisms from B to C, times morphisms from A to B to morphisms from A to C. And we're going to write it as, well, mapping, either mapping F, G to F composed with G, indicated by the little circle, or just FG, depending on what is typographically more convenient. Such that. Okay, so that's now all the data, right? Four things altogether: the objects, the morphisms, the identities, and the composition operation. And then we expect two things to hold. If we form the composite of three morphisms, F composed with G, composed with H, equals F composed with G composed with H, of course, only when this is defined. And similarly, the identity is supposed to be an actual identity, so F composed with the identity of A equals F, and the same for the identity on the other side, well, now I'm going to make the profile for F explicit that makes this defined, so F is then, if both these things are defined, then that means that F is a morphism from A to B. Okay, here, of course, when I say when defined, you should always prick your ears. When an operation is partial and somebody writes down an equation such as associativity, there's at least four different ways that I can think of my offhand right now to read these equations. So, for instance, if both equations, if both sides are defined, then they're equal. Or if one side is defined, then so is the other, and they're equal. Or if one side is defined and the small bit on the other side is defined, then the entire other side is defined and they're equal, and goes on like this, right? So here there's no problem because evidently this thing here being defined just means that F, G, and H join up like this, and then of course the other signs are defined as well, and conversely. Right, so this is an unproblematic condition. Okay. No, what can I wipe? Nothing. Yeah, no. Let's just talk about briefly about the examples that are on the board. I just have to mention them again. I'm not going to write anything additional here, right? So we see, I'm just going to write what the objects and the morphisms are, right? So here, these things basically are the morphisms, the objects. For instance, sets can be objects of a category. Partially ordered sets are object of a category. Here we see the category, for instance, sets or partially ordered sets. Here we see the morphisms, right? So the morphisms in the category of sets are just all maps. The morphisms in the category of posets are all monotone maps. In both cases, composition is just composition, as we know in Levitt, and in both cases, identities are just identity maps. Right, here. K vector spaces form a category. So these animals here, vector space with addition and scalar multiplication, such a vector, well, that's a vector space, and these are the objects of the category. And and the linear maps, I'm afraid, have disappeared, right? So let's write this here. The morphisms of the category are linear maps. And again, composition is just composition, and identity is identity. Okay, so the motivating examples from the beginning are actually categories in this sense. So the idea is basically that the objects serve as an abstraction of the notion of mathematical structure. And the message of this is, looking at the objects alone tells you nothing, right? So the objects are just a class, totally unstructured to begin with. The important bit are the morphisms. So the only way I say what a mathematical structure actually is by saying what the structure preserving maps are. So that's the only thing I care about in a mathematical structure. So the structure preserving maps, if you will, are the morphisms. Of course, so this maps is already a metaphor that we will at some point want to get rid of. So I'm just going to write some more examples here, I guess. So I'm going to write them in shape of a table, but I'll need to explain lots of stuff on the side. So what, how much do I want to show them? So let me repeat what we've seen, right? So we've seen the category sets, which has sets as the objects and maps as the morphisms. Then the category pos, where the objects are partially ordered sets and the morphisms are monotone maps. And the category of K vector spaces, where Well, the objects are K vector spaces and, well, let me write this more fully. The morphisms are K linear maps, meaning I can pull scalar multiplication with K out of the map. I've only just called this a linear map previously, but in particular, when I have a C vector space, a complex vector space, then it makes a difference whether a map is R linear or actually C linear. And there are separating examples. Okay, what else? Let's continue in the same vein, basically structured sets and structure preserving maps for two more examples. The category of graphs, or more precisely directed graphs. So I'm going to write these things as sets with an arrow relation, and arrow is just a binary relation on the set X. So we think of the elements of X as being the nodes of the graph, and of the elements of arrow as being the edges of the graph. So they're directed because they can go, well, there can be an arrow between two objects, but not the other way around. And the morphisms are going to be the graph homomorphisms, which are just the maps that preserve this relation here, right? So whenever I have an arrow from X to Y, I should have an arrow from Fx to Fy, right? So that's the graph homomorphism. Important structure for computer scientists, right? Evidently. Then, monoids. I'm going to explain somewhere else what a monoid is. So here I'm just going to say the objects are going to be the monoids. We see a pattern here, right? The categories are typically named by their objects. This is not entirely justified, as I said earlier. I mean, the important thing about a category is really the morphisms and not the objects. So this here, this category here should really be called the category of K-linear maps and not the category of K-vector spaces. But then it becomes slightly difficult when you say, okay, so I have the category of group homomorphisms, and then how do I restrict this to the category of abelian groups, right, the commutative ones? So do I call a morphism between two commutative or abelian groups, do I call this an abelian group homomorphism? I mean, there's no other condition there except the one that you always have for homomorphism, right? So, okay, so this is hard to get rid of, so we're just going to keep using that. And the morphisms are going to be the monoid homomorphisms, or just to save some shock, I'm usually just going to call anything that's called a homomorphism a morphism. So in particular, as this kind of thing will later be called a graph morphism, and this here will be called a monoid morphism. Okay, so I promised I would explain what a monoid is. Stay here. Okay, so what's a monoid? A monoid M is a triple, actually, that consists of an underlying set, which I'm also going to call M, and two operations, where the dot here is a binary operation on M that I write infix, and E is just an element of M, and there's two laws, basically. First is that this monoid multiplication or monoid operation is associative, and the element E here is actually a neutral element. Yes.
The parentheses are wrong.
Oh, they're wrong. Yes. I mean, of course, the equation is correct, but so yeah, I actually do want to re-bracket. Yes, wasn't meant to be trivial. So, associative law and neutral element. So A times E equals A, and actually here we have to postulate that also that E is also a left neutral element, so that E times A equals A. And we say that a map F is a monoid morphism from M to N, if and only if F is compatible with these operations. So of course, I'm assuming that M and N are both monoids, I mean, as in our definition of category. And so both M and N come with these operations here. I'm now going to write them the same on both sides. So I'm giving up this distinction about priming things on the right-hand side, right? So I demand that F of A times B is the same as F of A times F of B. And I also demand that F of E, well, let's be slightly clear here. Let me allow myself to just indicate this by an index. So this here is the neutral element of M, and this should equal the neutral element of N. I'm assuming there was no mention of groups in engineering math, right?
There was.
There was, ha! So what was the definition of a group homomorphism? Not quite, right? There's a subtlety here.
Without the neutral element?
Without the condition on the neutral element, right? So actually, a group can be defined in various ways, right? So the way that a group is usually defined in mathematics is as just something with an associative binary operation, and then there's just an axiom saying that a neutral element should exist, and also they demand only that it's right neutral, not left neutral as we do here. And also one demands that inverses exist, and again these only need to be right inverses. And then it's actually proved that the right inverses are also left inverses, that the neutral element is also a left neutral element. And in the definition of group homomorphism, only this condition here appears. And what then, I'm not going to do this, the calculation is sort of like the one that we've seen for vector spaces a moment ago. It is then proved that the neutral element is preserved. But for monoids, this doesn't work. So then this whole thing depends very strongly on the existence of inverses. So without inverses, I have to postulate this. Okay, so that's a monoid morphism. So here's one. This here looks a bit unusual, maybe. What some people may know is this here, right? The group of remainders modulo n. So this thing here is the set of remainder classes from 0 to n, so basically an integer number falls into one of these classes, say square brackets I, if its remainder modulo n is precisely I. I can do the same thing for the natural numbers, of course. I can classify natural numbers according to what the remainder is when I try to divide them by n. And of course, I can, well, n isn't good, n is taken k. So I can map a natural number k to its remainder class modulo n. And that is a monoid morphism. Right? Well, proving this, monoid morphism from. And actually, it doesn't matter what I write here, so it will work in both cases. So let's say I want to talk about multiplication, then this is a monoid morphism. So for instance, if I multiply, not for instance, basically this says that if I multiply two numbers and then take the remainder class, this is the same as first taking the remainder classes and then multiplying the remainder classes in a well-defined way. Well, actually saying this is the same as saying that multiplication of remainder classes is well-defined. And this also, so it's not only compatible with times, but it also preserves the neutral elements. So for instance, the remainder class of the neutral element here, the remainder class of 1, is, so this is a square brackets 1. This really is the neutral element in this animal here. Okay. Okay, monoids and monoid homomorphisms, fine. So far, we've been following this sets and structure, or structured sets and structure preserving maps idea in the examples. We can do slightly different stuff. So for instance, we can form different categories that still have all sets as objects. So, for instance, there's a category par for partial maps, where the objects are still sets, but the morphisms in this category, so the morphisms from X to Y are partial maps, where I'll indicate partial maps by not writing a complete arrow here, but only half of the arrowhead here, right? Who can tell me what a partial map is? So we've talked about what a map is. A map is a left total, right unique relation. What's a partial map? Sorry, yeah, we leave out left total. We only demand right uniqueness, right? So let's write this down. Good. So basically, we say that a relation F between X and Y is a partial map, and write this partial arrow here from X to Y to indicate this. If and only if F is right unique. Some notation that will come in handy occasionally is we're going to still write F of X for an element X of capital X, of course. For the unique y with x comma y being an element of f, this is as in the usual case. But of course now, we can do this only if such a y actually exists, which it might not, right? So we're still going to write this. And otherwise, we're going to say that f of x is undefined. So if no such y exists, that's a quite useful formalism because it can still write terms and all that. Of course, now you really have to pay attention, right? So if you have write something like g of f of x, then there's two things that can happen. F of x could be defined and be something, some element y, and then we could just use this notation as shorthand for g of y. But it might be the case that f of x is already undefined, and nevertheless we still apply g to it, right? So so our convention for that is if we try to apply a function to something that's already undefined, then the result, of course, is still going to be undefined. So this way we get a reasonable reading for composite terms. And this reading is such that a term can be defined only if all its subterms are already defined. OK, so that's partial maps. So, and this in particular this convention defines composition, right? So we can, yes?
Couldn't we not make a real partial map to a real map by just extending the domain, codomain, whatever?
Codomain.
The targets by undefined, and then, well, everything is fine again. We don't have to use partials.
That is completely true, yeah. But we buy other difficulties with that. So, yes, but it works. Of course, right? So what was being said here is that yes, of course, we can just introduce an error value, right? We can make undefined an element of y, a new element, so we enlarge y by one element, which is just an error, and then basically we make the map total again by just throwing the error when something's undefined. Yeah, perfectly feasible approach. It's done often enough, but sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. Okay, and then there's the category rel. Well, actually, slightly unfortunately, rel is sometimes used as notation for graphs. But the one that we're going to use here is rel has unstructured sets as its elements, and the morphisms from X to Y in rel are just going to be the binary relations between x and y. So I write this as did we introduce power set? We did introduce power set, right? So the power set of x times y is the set of all relations between x and y, namely the set of all subsets of x times y. So now we drop the right unique assumption as well, right? So these things are neither left total nor right unique. There may be anything. Now, of course, it's maybe even less clear how to compose these animals. So let's make this explicit. So let's say we have a relation from y to z that is a subset of x times z, y times z, and we have a relation from x to y, so that's a subset of x times y. So then we define the composite of R and S, R composed with S, as well, it's going to be a subset of x times z, obviously, because that's the way the composition should go. So I'm going to have to I'm going to say when a typical element x comma z is in this relation. Well, I'm going to demand that there exists a y in between such that x comma y is an R and y comma z is in z. So let's see, does this fit? Sort of, right? So basically this says that whenever we have a situation like this, x is in relation R to y and y is in relation S to z, then here other way around, of course, was wrong here already. The typing was wrong. This is S and this is R, right? And so this is S and this is R. Then X is in relation R composed with S to Z. Okay, so that's composition of relations. This is, well, new to most, I would assume, but to some degree we do it all the time. So for instance, when we write R star, right, which is transitive closure, which I mean is something that computer scientists should be familiar with, in particular if they've seen our basic courses. So what is R star? Well, it's x and y in relation R star, if and only if I can find some finite chain of R steps between them that connects them. Well, where the star basically says this might be no step at all, and there's also the plus which says there needs to be at least one step. This is like in regular expressions, basically. And actually, this is one of the two standard semantics of regular expressions. So there are two standard semantics of regular expressions. One is in terms of words. That's the one most of you know, presumably. And one is in terms of relations. And in relations, star means transitive reflexive closure, plus means just transitive closure. Composition is composition in exactly the sense that we've just defined. What else? One is identity relation, zero is empty relation, plus is union. So, right, and so R star is just union from I equals zero to infinity of R to the N, no, I, and R to the I is just R composed with itself in exactly this sense, I times. Okay, so that's one reason this should be familiar. And the other is that composition of functions, of course, is just a special case of this. So what does it mean for this y here to be in relation s to x if s is a function? Well, it just means that y is f applied to x. And similarly, then this here, if this is a function g, then this relationship here means that x and z is g applied to y. So what I get overall is g composed with f applied to x, right? So standard composition is just what relational composition boils down to if the relations happen to be functions. Okay, so that's two examples of categories where the morphisms are not maps, but something different. And now let's do, we just manage this. Let's do two more bits. I'll just continue this table here so the blackboard is finished, but we'll just go on. Two more exotic examples, maybe. Well, in some sense, not exotic at all. If I have a monoid M, then this monoid is also a category. This should, in fact, become apparent by just looking at the very great similarity between the laws, right? So this here is the associative law, and here we've got the identity law, which we've also seen in the definition of categories. Except that, well, here, of course, for a monoid, the monoid operation is defined everywhere, while composition in a category is defined only if the arrows are joined. Well, what this means is, if we want to turn a monoid into a category, then this category has only one object. So all the morphisms go from that object into the object itself. And well, what does the annotation say? So I have to say what the morphisms from this one object to itself are in the category M. Well, these are just all the elements of M. Every element of the monoid becomes a morphism from star to star. Then my composition operation is just the monoid operation, and that the laws hold is part of the definition of what a monoid is. So that's one corner case. So basically, I trivialize the object part and keep only the notion of morphism. And the other thing that I can do is trivialize the morphism part. So let's say we have a partially ordered set X and less than or equal. So we can turn this, well, actually here I've given the set of objects, So I was meaning to actually list the objects. So this is not, so the set of objects or the class of objects is star in this case, and here the objects are the elements of X. So every element of the poset becomes an object. And okay, now my category is x then less than or equal. I have to say what the morphisms in this category are from an element x to an element y. And I'm going to decree that these are going to be, well, this is the only candidate for such a morphism is going to be the pair x and y itself. And it's going to be a morphism if and only if x is less than or equal to y. So in other words, between x and y, there is either no morphism at all if x is not less than or equal to y, Or if x is less than or equal to y, then there's precisely one, the pair x comma y itself. Okay, now. Now, what are the identities in this category? So given an object x, little x. What's the identity on little x? And there's only one candidate, right? Yep. Well, or just the pair, right? X comma x. Okay, and why is this a morphism? Well, yeah, and which property of postsets guarantees that this actually holds? Reflexivity, right? So this is okay, S is less than or equal to X, so the ordering is reflexive, and therefore this thing here is actually a morphism according to that definition, right? So again, this says that there is exactly one candidate morphism between X and Y, that's the pair X and Y itself, but only if X is less than or equal to Y. So the pair X comma X is a morphism because X is less than or equal to X. And then there's composition, so which way do I have to write this? So what's y comma z composed with x comma y? Yeah, that's x comma z, and why is this a morphism? Transitivity, right? That this here is a morphism means that y is less than or equal to z. This here is a morphism because I will run x is less than or equal to y. So by transitivity, x is less than or equal to z, and therefore this thing here really is a morphism. Right. So this shows sort of that the category theory can be seen as the marriage of order theory and algebra, if you will. So we have an order structure or order-like structure in the sense that we have morphisms between objects. So the objects are somehow, we can actually see them as being ordered by the existence of morphisms between them. Of course, there's more structure to it than that. And then there's the algebraic aspects that morphisms compose non-trivially. So even if I have only one object, which for a postset would always be trivial, right? So in one object postset is always just the point that stands in relation to itself, and that's it. But we retain trivial non-trivial structure even in that case because we have different morphisms that have this composition operation on them. Right, so we're going to treat some actual things that we can define and prove in categories next time. And so next time is the hand and date for the sheet, so I'll hopefully have the next sheet online by Friday. And like I said, if there's any questions, send email or drop by.